Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. In this episode, my guest is Connor Stedman, and our topic is carbon farming, a way to sequester carbon using perennial plants and by building soil. Connor Stedman is a naturalist, wilderness educator, and permaculture designer based in the Connecticut and Champlain Valleys of Western New England. He co-organized the 2012 Carbon Farming Course, which you can find more information about at carbonfarmingcourse.com, which was held in Chestnut Ridge, New York. Connor is also completing an MS in Natural Resources and Ecology Planning at the University of Vermont, and writing a manual on agroforestry systems for the Northeast U.S. This episode is part one of a two-part series, and focuses on an introduction to the process of carbon farming, some numbers on the potential quantities of carbon that can be stored, and the role of trees and perennial plants in this process. Our follow-up to this, the second part, is planned for October of 2012, and we'll pick up on some details from this episode and then delve fully into the use of soil for carbon farming. After listening to this episode, if you have any questions for Connor to answer in the second half of this series, leave a comment at thepermaculturepodcast.com or on the voicemail line 717-827-6266. You can also reach me via email show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy this time with Connor as much as I did. Now on to the interview. If you're ready, why don't you give us a little bit about your background and how you came to permaculture?
Sure. So my name's Connor Stedman, and I live in Western New England. I live in the Connecticut River Valley of Massachusetts and the Champlain Valley of Vermont right now. And I grew up with a certain permaculture presence in my household. My father was one of the early students at the Conway School of Landscape Design back in the 1970s. And so there was books like The Integral Urban House from the Farallones Institute and Permaculture One and things like that in our house growing up. My father had a brief career as a landscape designer before moving on to other things. And I had a connection to the natural world growing up through gardening and growing up fishing with my family and spending time in natural places. As a teenager, I woke up to some of the global crises, and through education I received and books I read and people I met. And what really was compelling to me about permaculture was that it offered solutions rather than just we need to stop doing the bad stuff. It offered good stuff to do, to put it really simply. So that was compelling to me, and I connected with the permaculture professional community in Western Massachusetts, and folks like Dave Jackie and Lisa DiPiano and John O'Niger and other folks, and have been connected with and working in that community ever since for the last 7 years or so.
Yeah, that's a community that's well known to me, and obviously with Dave's work and the Edible Forest Garden books also to my listeners as well. So you're in good company there. With what brought you to permaculture, because it was kind of a positive experience and gave solutions, is that one of the things that drew you to carbon farming, the main topic that I want to talk with you about tonight?
Yeah, definitely. I was, as I think many people have been, I was really, really flattened by learning about climate change, you know, 15 years ago or so, when that entered my awareness. And I felt a lot of grief and anger about the world changing beyond recognition was the future that I was afraid of. And I also felt a lot of powerlessness about it. It seemed like the problem was so big that solutions would have to be really big also. And that could only happen through large national or global institutions. And as one person, I didn't see an avenue for me to participate in that or make a significant difference. But I was really compelled by a big part of the original vision of permaculture from Mollison and Holmgren was this image of permanent agriculture, of integrated, long-term, perennial, over-yielding food systems. And they weren't really putting forward anything new at that point in Permaculture One. They were just combining elements that were already moderately to fairly well understood by other people into this integrated vision for how it could work together. And a lot of the stuff in Permaculture One is really just about tree crops with animals and a layout on a farm or ranch or community scale that makes sense spatially and energetically. So I was really compelled by that kind of original vision of perennial food systems, and the forest gardening and agroforestry side of permaculture was where I put a lot of my focus and work in designing forest gardens and managing them and seeing them through their early years of growth and development, usually on a relatively small scale. But I also was working on larger scale, usually organic, usually diversified farms around the U.S. in the first years that I was studying permaculture. And at the Young Farmers Conference in Tarrytown, New York, at the Stone Barn Center, which is an event that I really recommend people attend if they can, just for the collected energy and experience that's there. I was going to that event year after year and started thinking with people about larger scale farm applications of permaculture design, which of course people have been working about on and thinking about for a very long time. And there's been successful applications of that around the world, especially in Australia and the tropics. And I want to point to the work of Darren Doherty, especially from Australia, who's a keyline planner, which is a topic that's really probably beyond our one broadcast here, but it's a planning system for water and soil building and basically large scale restoration for really damaged landscapes that came out of Australia in the early part of the 20th century. So Darren Doherty had this vision of training people in carbon farming, of training people in agriculture that takes carbon out of the atmosphere and puts it into the soil and into trees. Maybe this is a good point to just talk about some of the basic science behind that and what that really means. For people who aren't familiar with some of the math of human-caused climate change, even if our global greenhouse gas emissions were cut to zero tomorrow, then there would still be something like 200 billion tons of carbon in the atmosphere that would be on top of the previous level of carbon in the atmosphere going back to about 1800. So there's already a built-up carbon surplus in the atmosphere from the last 200 years of the industrial age. And so you could imagine that there's kind of three approaches to responding to that carbon surplus. And one approach is to reduce the rate at which more carbon is being added to the atmosphere. And so a lot of, you know, people are doing that on a small scale through lifestyle choices and design choices, but they're especially in many cases trying to do that on a large scale through political action and through and laws and global agreements and things like that. So that's one broad leverage point. We could talk about which parts of that leverage point are more or less effective, but one broad strategy is to reduce the rate of carbon emissions. And another strategy is to adapt to a change in climate. So you could say, okay, well, even if the best case scenario happens, the climate's still changing. So we have to do things like drought-proof our farms and landscapes. We have to store water in the soil and in tanks for those hotter, drier years. We have to move plants north and think about wildlife corridors and things like that. And I think permaculture offers a lot of strategies for that whole adaptation strategy. But there's a third approach to climate change, and I really see this as an all-of-the-above question rather than picking one of these three. But the third approach is about taking carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it somewhere. And a lot of what's out there in the media about carbon sequestration is large-scale geoengineering projects, things like pumping carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it at the bottom of the ocean, or putting it into volcanoes, or things like that. And all of those are totally speculative, totally risky, may have unintended consequences that are worse than what they're trying to solve. And I think a dangerous eggs in one basket approach, if that was the only approach we were taking. But so the good news is that there's other ways to take carbon out of the atmosphere, and in particular, trees take carbon out of the atmosphere and sequester it in their wood, in their physical bodies. And soil holds carbon for decades or centuries in the form of the percentage of the soil that's organic matter. So if you're building organic matter in soil and you're growing trees, you're taking carbon out of the atmosphere and storing it for the long term. So the basic approach of carbon farming is to do agricultural production involving trees and soil building. And it's very complementary with the way of thinking that many people are already having about sustainable agriculture, such as organic farming or conservation farming or permaculture. Because it turns out that if you're using perennial crops and building soil, you're not just taking carbon out of the atmosphere, but you're also building a healthier and more resilient and less chemically toxic agroecosystem. And then that's better for local people and the food system. So it's a win-win possibility.
So this process of using the agroforestry that comes from within permaculture and some of the ideas that come with it, adapted to each of the local bioregions as necessary, allows us to get more carbon out of the air into the plants that we're growing while also building it in the soil for future generations.
Right. And I think it's really important to note there that permaculture didn't think up agroforestry. It didn't think up rotational grazing. It didn't think up the integration of animals with trees. It didn't think up water storage in the landscape. All of those things are forms of traditional ecological knowledge that people have been doing for thousands of years in locally adapted ways all over the planet. And, you know, permaculture's genius in a lot of ways is in having a design system that integrates those strategies. But the strategies themselves are very old and practiced and understood around the planet, and especially in the tropics.
So as people are moving forward and using these various ideas that were once disparate that are now kind of assembled in one package, if someone wanted to start using these methods, what kind of sequestration are you talking about that's possible in the soil and in the plants? And is that something that you can break down on like a by acre amount, or is there a different scale that you like to use?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's really helpful to get some sense of quantity in talking about this, especially as is currently happening in Australia, especially as more and more countries around the world are putting a price on carbon, which, in other words, monetizing the sequestration of carbon. That's really something that's just in its very early stages, but it's helpful to understand what we're really talking about.
One of my earlier guests was Mary Johnson.
Oh, great.
We were talking about the RED programs for reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation in developing countries. And she touched someone how she was working with indigenous populations to put a value on the land that they were working for carbon sequestration. So we did have a bit of a general discussion of that, but we never got to the math.
Great. Well, let's look at the math a little bit. And I want to credit Eric Tonesmeyer here, who's the co-author of Edible Forest Gardens with Dave Jackie, who's done a lot of research in recent years on carbon farming and on carbon sequestration through perennial agriculture. And he has multiple articles out on this topic, some of which have been published in the Permaculture Activist, and a forthcoming book on this topic in the coming years. Again, there's essentially two ways to store carbon in an agricultural landscape. And one of them is in trees, and one of them's, or any perennial plants really, but trees have a significantly greater carbon storage potential than most herbaceous perennial plants. Although deep-rooted prairie bunch grasses and the complex prairie polycultures associated with them are another significant area to store carbon in. And then the other place is organic content in the soil. And let's just start with the image of a conventional agroecosystem as it exists right now, which is biologically dead soil, fed by nitrogen fertilizer and maintained from pests through chemical pesticides, managed by combines and harvesters on a scale of thousands of acres. That's where the calories that feed a significant portion of the world come from right now. And that system is a huge contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, not just from the use of vehicles and fuel, but also from the Haber-Bosch process that manufactures the nitrogen fertilizer. So there's multiple places in the current conventional chemical ag system that are a significant contributor to climate change. Now, the research is all over the map on what the amount of carbon that converting that kind of agricultural landscape to agroforestry can sequester. But the numbers range from around 10 tons per hectare. And I'm going to use hectare here because most of the research has been done in parts of the world that use the hectare as a unit of measurement rather than the acre. So it ranges from just under 10 tons per hectare to over 200 tons per hectare sequestered by converting to agroforestry from annual farming. And just for folks who might not have seen or thought about a hectare before, a hectare is about 2 acres. So we're looking at between 10 and 200 tons per hectare. We could use a conservative estimate and say maybe 20 or 25 tons per hectare on average sequestered over the lifetime of, or over the establishment period of the agroforestry system. And that's on the trees side. Again, that's just, for example, to use a common alley cropping example, that's just interplanting tree crops in with annual field crops. So you could grow, in a US example, would be growing black walnuts for timber in between patches of corn and soybeans in a rotation, or wheat and soybeans in a rotation. And that's done in some parts of the US, such as Missouri and other parts of the lower Midwest. So just the addition of a tree crop component into existing annual agroecosystems can sequester at least 10 tons of carbon per hectare. And again, most of the traditional food forestry systems from the tropics that this modern agroforestry is modeling after are much more complex than that, and are predominantly involving perennials and are involving a polyculture of many different crops rather than just an annual and a tree crop. So the carbon sequestration potential of the more complex food forestry is a lot higher. Now, on the soil side, a 1% increase in soil organic matter can sequester up to 80 tons of atmospheric carbon per hectare, or 40 tons per acre. So one thing this points to is that carbon farming has the greatest sequestration potential on the most degraded agricultural landscapes, because tree crop farming systems sequester less carbon than wild forest, but significantly more than current conventional farming systems. So from a carbon sequestration point of view, the highest return direction to go in is to turn currently conventionally farmed landscapes into agroforestry landscapes. And there's places around the world where people are attempting that, especially in Australia and parts of the tropics where the older history is the tree crop farming and the more recent history is the annual farming.
Is there any information coming out on the storage capacity of the more complex systems?
No, and there's a real research gap, which has been commented on by a number of people in looking at the way permaculture has developed in the last 30 years. My friend Rafter Sass Ferguson is doing doctoral research right now on permaculture in the United States and its impact on farming and gardening and people's lives and other things. So there might be, I don't know if there's a carbon sequestration portion of that, but I'm not aware of specific research on the more complex systems. But at the upper end of that agroforestry range, 200 tons of carbon per hectare is pretty significant. Now, it might be useful to review what these carbon farming practices are. And because essentially what we're talking about here is scaling permaculture up from the backyard or homestead or community garden scale that it's often practiced on, onto an enterprise scale, a production scale, And there's certain things that are different about it. So on a large enterprise scale, polycultures, meaning combinations of different species, polycultures have to be simpler than they might be in a really complex backyard forest garden. And there's pretty significant practical and financial reasons behind that. You know, Dave Jackie, author of Edible Forest Gardens, I've heard him say this many times. He says he doesn't actually recommend that people apply the hyper-diverse forest gardening directly to the design of many acre, making someone's livelihood agroecosystems, because we just don't know how to do it at that scale well enough yet. But we do know how to do simpler polycultures at a larger scale, especially in the tropics where that traditional knowledge has remained closer to the mainstream over time. So I want to talk about two different kinds of agroforestry that are relevant for carbon farming, and then talk a little bit about keyline as another soil building and land restoration practice from Australia, and then mention a few other things about soil. And I think that'll probably use most of the rest of our time.
Then please, the floor is yours.
So the first kind of agroforestry system that I want to highlight here is what is often called in the U.S. alley cropping, and elsewhere in the world it might be called food forestry or tree crop farming. And this is production systems that are oriented around and dominated by tree crops. And again, I want to point to the traditional knowledge from the tropics as a real source of this farming system, where Charles Mann, who's the author of the book 1491, writes about how it's increasingly clear that large percentages of the biodiversity and composition of the Amazon rainforest are a legacy of human management. They're a legacy of traditional indigenous forestry practices going back thousands of years. So people have been growing diverse tree crop agriculture in the tropics for a very long time. They've also been doing it in the temperate world. I got to spend some time with a woman, Dr. Kat Anderson at UC Davis, who is an ethnoecologist, and she's written this book, Tending the Wild, based on 20 years of oral history work with Native elders around California. And she documents the traditional management of what many of people have come to think of as wild ecosystems in California. They weren't wild. They were managed through disturbance, such as fire and tilling and pruning and coppicing. They were managed through seeding and propagation. They were managed through selective harvest of animal populations and creating favorable habitat for animals. And then the animals themselves changed the ecosystem as well. So it's a picture of humans as a keystone species, as keystone horticulturists, hunter-gatherer horticulturists in a sense. That's really much more of the, quote, prehistory of humanity than what has often been thought of as hunter-gatherers leaving no trace. It's more like hunter-gatherer gardeners. And what we're relearning in doing diversified tree crop farming is really comes from this older tradition, from the tropics, from around the temperate world, and even from more recent history. So in Southern Europe and Western Europe, there's a long history of what they call silvo-arable farming systems or silvo-agriculture, which is alley cropping. They grow rows of vegetables with rows of fruit trees in between them. And the fruit trees provide shade for shade-loving crops. They provide habitat for wildlife. They provide an additional crop. They provide diversity. And those systems have been rapidly disappearing in the conversion to mechanized industrial farming in the last 100 years. But there's still some around in Italy and France and Greece and places like that. So there's a lot to say about farming with tree crops, but it's very different than agriculture with annuals because the time scale is so different. So if I'm growing I'm going to make up a simple polyculture here. So I might grow chestnuts and peaches with gummies as a nitrogen-fixing shrub in the understory. I might add some things to that as I'll talk about in a minute. So if I'm growing chestnuts and peaches with a nitrogen-fixing shrub in the understory, then I might not get a marketable yield from the chestnut trees for 8 to 10 years. The peaches would start production much sooner than that. But because I'm not getting a marketable yield for 8 to 10 years, that sets in motion a number of things in the enterprise planning that are very different from a single year cycle for an annual crop. I need to have consistent land access and tenure for the whole length of that maturation of that crop, or else it doesn't make sense to plant. I shouldn't plant the trees if I might get kicked off in 2 years. If you're not growing for commercial production, then this calculus might look a little different. You might choose to plant trees knowing that you might not be there to harvest from them. But for business planning, which is what we're talking about here, if we want to do carbon farming on a larger scale, in other words, make it profitable to sequester carbon through agriculture, then the land tenure part is really significant for having long-lived tree crop systems. So that's one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is that the return on the initial investment is spread out over, in some cases, decades. And one thing that points to is planting successions of crops rather than simply planting chestnuts and saying, I'll get my return in 10 years. So while the chestnuts and peaches are in their early stages, not producing shade yet, not really producing marketable yields yet, I might be growing berries in the understory, strawberries, currants, raspberries, and having that as a year 1 to 3 crop. And then the peaches come on and I transplant some of those berries out. I keep some of them because currants are shade tolerant up to a certain extent. And then as the chestnuts come on, I'm harvesting from those. And then the peaches die after 20 or 25 years and I replace those. So it's a lot like succession planting in an annual garden over the course of a single season, except it might play out over decades. And that kind of polyculture planning is it's an exciting new frontier in a lot of ways, especially in the temperate world. In the tropics, there's been an unbroken line of people doing that kind of agriculture in pockets around the tropical world. And so we can pattern our temperate systems off of some of what they've learned. One thing that's been learned in the tropics that holds true, as far as we can tell, in temperate systems as well, is that if you want to sequester a lot of carbon and build a lot of soil and have an ecological analog system that's functioning in the way that a forested ecosystem might, with cycling nutrients and providing habitat and all those things that we're working towards in a lot of permaculture design, then a key link is the self-renewing fertility and especially the self-renewing nitrogen cycle in the system, because a lot of nitrogen is removed from the system when crops are harvested. So you either need animals to add nitrogen back into the soil through their manure, and they don't need to necessarily be grazed underneath the trees because they can also, manure can be collected and added as compost, but you need animals or you need a lot of nitrogen fixers. And in some research that's been done in Mexico, some people working on more complex, diverse tree crop systems were finding that 40 to 60% of the planting area needed to be in nitrogen-fixing trees and shrubs in order to have fully self-replacing fertility for their crop plants. So obviously that's just one data point from one farm, but it points to the principle of fix a lot of nitrogen.
That also is reinforced by other research. I think it was John Jeevan and also master gardeners throughout the United States who are looking at how much land is necessary for one person to produce all their food. And in the square footage that they were presenting, about 70% of what they were growing was entirely to return fertility to the soil.
Right. Yeah. So we could take an average that something like half of your growing area, and maybe more, is fertility crops. Now, if you have animals, that equation can change because animals are able to cycle nutrients in ways that just plant-based systems aren't. So that's a good segue into a second kind of agroforestry that I want to talk about, which is silvopasture, or the combination of animals with trees. Silvopasture, again, has been practiced around the world for a long time. It's currently being practiced around the world in a lot of different combinations. It's complex. On a basic level, there's two different kinds of silvopasture. One of them is pasturing animals partially or fully in existing forested landscapes. And the other one is adding trees to existing pasture. So from a carbon farming point of view, adding trees to existing pasture has potentially a higher carbon sequestration potential because of the sequestration that trees will do. People who work with silvopasture continually note that silvopasture really primarily works in combination with rotational grazing. So a fixed pen silvopasture system is going to be little better than a fixed pen pasture system ecologically and for the animal's health and happiness and for the quality of the product. It's really through the rotation that allows pastures to regenerate that both builds more soil organic matter over time and provides some of the benefits of silvopasture to the animals. That's one thing to keep in mind with silvopasture is that it's a rotational system, and the work of Holistic Management International has been really important in figuring out some of the science and management practices and decision-making frameworks for how to do the complex management of rotational grazing. And there's a hundred different systems that get adapted to the specifics of a particular place, a particular farm. What's really important for silvopasture is understanding the particular animal that you're working with. So, for example, cows have a different ecological niche than sheep, which have a different ecological niche than goats, and have a different ecological niche than pigs. And so all of them point towards slightly different silvopasture systems. Pigs, which are omnivorous, are especially well suited to silvopasture. And because of the impact that they have, since they don't just graze, but they uproot things and they wallow and they dig, they require a longer rotation period than something that's just a grazer like a cow. There's a lot of resources out there on silvopasture. There's a great handbook that you can search for, which is Meet Goats in Your Woodland, which I haven't had a chance to fully read through yet, but I love the title. There's also, for folks who live in the eastern U.S. especially, there's Northeast Silvopasture Conference last year in 2011, and the whole proceedings of that conference are online, available for free download. I just got to visit a silvopasture farm here in Massachusetts that's rotating pigs, and the way they do it is each pasture has an adjacent woodland area that the pigs have access to at all times. And they said that the silvopasture system they were using wasn't any additional work. It was not greater work or greater cost than just rotating their pigs in the pasture, but it made healthier, happier pigs and a significantly better tasting and higher quality pork product because of the more diversified diet the pigs were getting from the forest and because of the significant reduction in heat stress by having shade available to them at all time. And forest shade is higher quality shade than that which can be provided from a portable shade tent. There's a lot of farm system win-win potential built into silvopasture beyond its potential for sequestering carbon. But adding trees and using rotational grazing can build both the tree carbon and the soil carbon at the same time. And so it has a lot of potential from a carbon farming perspective. So those are two systems I want to highlight around the use of tree in agriculture. And just a few last numbers I want to give are that there's a significant amount of the world's farmland that's sloping. There's slopes between maybe 6 and 15%, and sloping farmland is vulnerable to erosion. And one of the best strategies to remediate erosion on sloping soils is through perennial root systems, and especially trees. So adding a tree component to agriculture on sloping soils has the potential to sequester a significant amount of carbon. Eric Tonesmeyer's research shows that just converting the world's farmland that's on soils of 8% slope or greater would sequester close to 17 billion tons of carbon which is just under 10% of that 200 billion ton number. So a closing thought I want to give with that is that carbon farming isn't a silver bullet. It's not a geoengineering silver bullet that's going to make climate change go away. Instead, it's a high leverage strategy for remediating and responding to climate change that should be a significant part of climate change strategies on local and regional and national, international levels as part of a try everything kind of response. And a big step that's been taken in that is the recent carbon farming legislation in Australia, where as part of their new national carbon tax, there's a small percentage of the revenue from the carbon tax that gets paid back to farmers to pay them for the carbon that they're sequestering on their farm. That's a really promising development from a policy level. From a enterprise agriculture point of view, I think the really exciting work is in figuring out how to make regenerative agriculture profitable so that there's a set of incentives that allows farmers and communities and land trusts and other people with access to land and capital to convert agriculture from degenerative to regenerative. And we're in luck in a lot of ways because the same farming strategies that build a more sustainable food system also sequester carbon.
And some good news, Warren Brush in Santa Barbara, California is putting together a demonstration site to show the financial viability of a perennial farming system, a regenerative farm.
That's great. And that kind of work is really an opening for that kind of work in many different bioregions, because the practices that can take root in Southern California, where Warren Brush is, the patterns and principles might be the same, but the crops and the systems and the management might look very different in Minnesota or in Southern Florida or other places with their unique climate and their unique history and hardiness and local culture and all the other factors. So it's really, to me, it's exciting because in each place around the world, people can work toward regenerative agriculture in their place. And that makes a contribution to this larger project. And I just want to say, I could have said this at the beginning of the interview, didn't think of it, but I was one of the organizers of the carbon farming course in early 2012. My co-organizer is Ethan Rowland of Appleseed Permaculture in the Hudson Valley of New York. And we had a powerful, successful event with trainers on regenerative agriculture from around the world. And if people want to see photos and get a sense of what that event was like, they can go to carbonfarmingcourse.com. And future events of that nature will be posted there in future years.
I was happy to see one of our local authors, Charles Eisenstein, was a part of your process.
Yes, he was. He was one of our panelists on our Financing Regenerative Agriculture Day. And that's, I think, a significant part of this whole equation is making the financing and budgeting and investment and profitability side of things work for farmers to use regenerative practices.
One of the suggestions that was made to me was that all this grant money that's available, instead of going after the grant money, we have to go after the capital money to get some proper investment in this that's a long-term approach, not a short-term, let's complete a project idea.
That suggests working along the slow money line of thinking.
Yes.
Where people with access to financial capital, giving them ways to move that financial capital from the global financial system into local economies and local farms and local regenerative businesses like carbon farming enterprises.
Given your time frame, I don't want to keep you much longer, but we'll do this again in a second episode sometime soon and continue the conversation with the soil.
Sounds great. We can also do follow up on some things that we touched on briefly in this first episode.
Okay. I'll see if the listeners have any questions or additional input from what they hear, and we can take it from there.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot, Scott.
All right. Thank you, Connor.
Thank you for joining me for another interview. If you have comments or questions about this or any other episode, go to thepermaculturepodcast.com and leave a message or send me an email. That address is show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. Until the next time, take care of yourself, the Earth, and each other.